First reading is Micah chapter 5, verses 1 to 4. Now, daughter who is under attack, you slash yourself in grief. A siege is set against us. They are striking the judge of Israel on the cheek with a rod. Bethlehem Ephrathah, you are small among the clans of Judah. One will come from you to be ruler over Israel for me. His origin is from antiquity, from eternity. Therefore, he will abandon them until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers will return to the people of Israel. He will stand and shepherd them in the strength of Yahweh, in the majestic name of Yahweh his God. They will live securely, for then his greatness will extend to the ends of the earth. And the second reading is Luke chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that the whole empire should be registered. This first registration took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. So everyone went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family line of David, to be registered along with Mary, who was engaged to him and was pregnant. While they were there, the time came for her to give birth. Then she gave birth to her firstborn son, and she wrapped him snugly in cloth and laid him in a feeding trough because there was no room for them at the lodging place.
Thanks, Liz. Well, here's a question for you. If you're a Christian here today, what do you find the most compelling thing about the Christian faith? What is it that brings you back time and time again? If you're not a Christian here today, if you're somebody, maybe you're searching, maybe you're skeptical, first of all, it's so good that you're here, and I hope that you find your time with us really helpful for wherever you're at life. But here's a question for you. What do you find it is that you can't accept about the Christian faith? What's that kind of blocker? In today's passage, the opening verses of chapter 2, in these events around the birth of Jesus, which is narrated, I think there are three compelling reasons to take the Christian faith very seriously. One of the challenges of many contemporary conversations, arguments or debates around the relative merits of Christian faith is that there can often be almost confusion before the arguments even take place about what we're actually talking about. So take, for example, I'm going to show you in a few moments a video clip of the British comedian and well-known atheist, Ricky Gervais, as he appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Don't worry, this is a clean clip, so there's it's a clean version. But it's interesting, what he's doing in this clip, he's defending why his trust in science is a better foundation kind of compared to how people put their faith in particular religious teachings. We'll play the clip and maybe
but science is constantly proved all the time. You see, if we take something like any fiction, in any holy book, in any other fiction, and destroyed it, okay, in 1,000 years' time, that wouldn't come back just as it was. Yes. Whereas if we took every science book, right, and every fact, and destroyed them all, in 1,000 years, they'd all be back, because all the same tests would be the same result.
That's good. That's really good.
So we
That's
don't...
really good.
I don't need faith in science. I don't need faith to know that probably if I jump out of a window, every other time someone jumped out, they smash to the ground because of this thing called gravity.
Just one more time, I think, because I think...
But science is constantly proved all the time. You see, if we take something like any fiction, in any holy book, in any other fiction, and destroyed it, okay, in 1,000 years' time, that wouldn't come back just as it was. Yes. Whereas if we took every science book, right, and every fact, and destroyed them all, in 1,000 years, they'd all be back, because all the same tests would be the same result.
That's good. That's really good.
So we
That's
don't.
Really good.
I don't need faith in science. I don't need faith to know that probably if I jump out of a window, every other time someone jumped out, they smash to the ground because of this thing called gravity.
All right. Now, it's quite. You hear the comment. It's quite a compelling argument in many ways. You can even hear the host, Stephen Colbert, who himself is a self-professed Catholic, he says that's good, that's really good, his argument, right? But do you notice the assumption that Ricky Gervais sort of smuggled into his argument there about the relative merits of trusting in science versus religion? His argument rests on the assumption that the integrity of religious belief should be assessed through the grid that we use to assess the integrity of a scientific claim. That is, a robust scientific claim, something like gravity, for example, that needs to be repeatable, testable, and of course, when you come to science textbooks, if you burn them all, his argument is, you burn every single science textbook, you burn them all, in 1,000 years' time, they'll all come back again, even though we do know that science textbooks 1,000 years ago were very different to the ones today, but that's a different thing. But if you did, his point still makes sense, right? Science, by its very nature, is looking around at the world around us, making observations, tests, based on, you know, repeatable patterns. You know, it's kind of like he's saying that these laws, things like gravity, will come back again in 1,000 years' time, even if we burn all the books that talk about gravity. Now, what's the problem with his argument? According to Ricky Gervais, religious belief is silly and unnecessary because it can't be reproduced simply by observing the chemicals in the ground or the laws of physics or something like that. But this is the problem, right? With Ricky Gervais and his logic, for him to be consistent, his problem would be for any historical claim. That is, if you destroyed every piece of evidence that World War II happened, would World War II magically, miraculously reappear in history textbooks in 1,000 years' time? Of course it wouldn't. Does that make the reality of the events of World War II less credible than the claims of the existence of gravity? Of course not. Why? Well, seems obvious, doesn't it? Science and history, they're two very different disciplines. In fact, I think Ricky Gervais even forgets this as he is in his final remarks. He said, you know, he was sort of saying in 1,000 years' time, he said he would still know that if you jumped off a cliff, you'd fall to the bottom and smash to the ground. Why? Because every other time people have done it, it's happened due to this thing called gravity. What Ricky Gervais is not acknowledging is that the Christian faith is much more closely aligned to the discipline of history than it is to the discipline of science, as wonderful as science is. That is, Christianity is about news of remarkable, not repeating events that have happened in history. And yes, like any piece of history, if it were possible to remove every reference to these historical events ever happening, they wouldn't naturally emerge again in 1,000 years' time. But here's what we have. In God's kindness, we do have the historical evidence of remarkable events happening 2,000 years ago. In fact, the passage before us today presents the events of the birth of Jesus not by saying, I have set out to explain the science behind the birth of Jesus, but Luke, the author of the Gospel, is locating these events in the pages of history. See these verses from the opening of Luke's Gospel. We looked at these a few weeks ago. Many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as the original eyewitnesses and servants of the word handed them down to us. It also seemed good to me, since I have carefully investigated everything from the very first, to write to you an orderly sequence, most honourable Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things about which you have been instructed. Then it goes, in the days of King Herod of Judea, and it goes on. This is not a science textbook, but nor is it a book of detached religious dogma teachings just dropping out of the sky. These are in history, located in history, in the days of King Herod of Judea. Now, we know that King Herod died around 4 BC, which means that Jesus actually was born between 4 to 6 BC, but that's not an error of the Bible. It's actually due to when the modern calendar was compiled many years later, when they didn't know about Herod's timing, so they kind of made a miscalculation. But in chapter 2 of Luke's Gospel, we get more historical detail. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that the whole empire should be registered. This first registration took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. So everyone went to be registered, each to his own town. Now here, if you're the kind of person who follows the various articles about Christmas from in the Herald and other places, you often get a lot of skeptics of Christianity around this time of year, rightly pointing out that there's a bit of a discrepancy going on here, because Quirinius came on the scene around 6 AD, and if Herod died 4 BC, there seems to be an historical gap of around 10 years about when the birth of Jesus actually happened. And you'll often read articles at this time of year saying, see, the whole of the Gospels falls apart, must be a myth because they get these dates, they don't line up. And Christians, as we respond to these things, we should be cautious to be really quick to say, no, there's no problems here, no difficulty at all. We've got to actually not pretend that these discrepancies aren't there, at least to us as modern readers. It is true that based on our current knowledge of historical events, on face value, it seems like the times of King Herod and Quirinius don't actually line up neatly. However, we also have to note, as historian John Dixon points out, if you're familiar with his work, we've only got access to about 1% of the historical documents from that era. And simply because we don't know how these things overlap doesn't mean there is no explanation for how they're compatible that we have not yet realised. For example, for many years, people would say that in John's Gospel, the reference to the Pool of Siloam, that's just been added in because there's no evidence of this Pool of Siloam. It's clearly not there. And of course, in 2004, the Pool of Siloam was discovered by archaeologists, right? For many years, it's like, oh, that's obviously been added in. No. So it is possible that the census took place, for example, in Herod's reign, and the results were processed and delivered. You know, a bit like how when we do our census, it takes about 6 months for the results to come out. You can imagine that maybe it happened in Herod's reign, and by the time Quirinius came in governing Syria, that's when the results were released. There are a whole bunch of possibilities, right? But what seems clear is that Luke wrote this gospel, and his first readers clearly did not have any difficulty with the mentioning of Herod and Quirinius in these verses. He's clearly positioning these events not as a holy book dropping out of the sky, but a set of historical events that exist in human civilization in time and space. So that's the first reason I find the Christian faith and the birth of Jesus we can see so compelling. It is in history. The second one is that these are not just events about a birth in history. The birth of Jesus is compelling because it's a royal birth. You see there in verse 4, Joseph went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family line of David, to be registered along with Mary, who was engaged to him and was pregnant. Now, for original readers, again, the mention of Bethlehem would have been no small thing. Those who are familiar with their Old Testament, who heard the first reading that Liz read out before, they'll know that the birth of the ruler of God's people which was prophesied hundreds of years earlier, would come from, as Micah says, 5 verse 2, Bethlehem. Bethlehem, you are small among the clans of Judah. One will come from you to be ruler over Israel for me. His origin is from antiquity, from eternity. So it's one thing to kind of come to terms with the historicity of the birth of Jesus. You go, okay, right, it happened in history. I get that. But if Jesus was not any different than any other historical figure, you say, well, big deal, right? Great, that's a bit of historical trivia. I can add that to my historical trivia list and I'll move on. But if you read in this text, the text itself doesn't just let us move on very easily, straight without wrestling with something more than just the history of it. The birth of Jesus is in line with promises about where God's eternal ruler would be born. So in one sense, if you're sitting there, okay, here's Jesus, I don't want him to have a lot of authority over my life. I don't want this eternal ruler over me. I'm going to pick holes in the historicity so I don't have to really wrestle with the awkwardness that Jesus is not just a lovely little baby, but the ruler of all for eternity. This is a birth of massive cosmic significance, so much more than any royal baby in history, certainly any royal baby today. Third reason why the birth of Jesus is so compelling, and possibly the most surprising, is that the birth of Jesus doesn't just come in history, doesn't just come in royalty, but comes in humility. Verse 6, while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. Then she gave birth to her firstborn son, and she wrapped him in snugly cloth and laid him in a feeding trough because there was no room for them at the lodging place. You notice in that little description there, the time came. It's like a subtle acknowledgement to the timing is perfectly in line with God's time. It's all been mapped out. Now, I was hoping that Elise would be here this Sunday. We didn't know God's timing. She gave birth on Wednesday morning. We're seeing here that this birth is so clearly in line with God's timing. But more than God's timing, the manner of this birth is perfectly consistent with God's character. His humility, his gentleness, the unassuming setting for Jesus' birth. There were angels, yes. There was a star. There was a bunch of other special supernatural events marking this birth out as unique. But there's a kind of a juxtaposition of this cosmic power with this quiet humility. I think one of the things that compel people to the Christian faith and also repel them is the packaging. That is, the apparent weakness and foolishness. The Apostle Paul writes in the letter to the Corinthians, talking about God's wisdom is so often shown in the weak things of the world. But here's the thing. What often repels people, so people, that is so weak, foolish, pathetic, is often also the very thing that brings other people in. The kind of peace on earth that Jesus offers is not the peace that is enforced by military power, like the Pax Romana, the Roman Empire kind of peace, the military rule kind of peace. I was watching Star Wars the other day, and there's the peace, the Emperor, and then we will have peace, you know, in the Empire when all the Jedi have been destroyed. It's not that kind of peace. What is so compelling about the birth of Jesus is that Jesus arrives with an invitation to those who are not just compelled by his royalty, but his humility, who need the servant king. And that's what King Herod couldn't cope with. That's what many people around the world today still can't cope with. So, I think when we think about religion, spirituality, there can be a danger, I think, as we try to work out, does God exist? We can kind of assume or wish that God would kind of work, kind of like with the disciplines of science. That is, we can kind of approach the reality of God a little bit like Ricky Gervais does in that interview, putting the existence of God under his microscope, testing God, setting up a bunch of laws and rules and hoops that God must jump through must be observed and repeated. But the problem with this approach to God, it sort of sounds like the obvious, but who's playing the part of God? Ricky Gervais in that situation, he's putting himself above God. This is what it must be. When you put God in that way, you're sort of sitting above God. God's got to work on our terms, like a scientist is trying to make the rules in the lab. But this is not how God relates to us. And yet, God relates to us even though we're not called to relate to him like a scientist in a lab. God in his kindness doesn't just drop a holy book out of the sky and say, look, read it, trust me, do it. What is so compelling about the Christian faith, it's trusting in a person who came in the pages of history with history-changing authority and of cosmic importance, but a person who came not as a narcissist, but a radical, humble servant. What is so compelling, I think, about the Christian faith is not so much a religion, but about trusting that God has showed up in history, in the person of Jesus, with the authority and the humility to give this world hope. Are you at all compelled by Jesus? Let's pray. Father, we do thank you that you have entered this world in the person of your Son. And we thank you that you have sent him to be our eternal King. And we thank you that he has come into this world not as a tyrant, but as a humble servant. We ask that you will help us today to receive him afresh. Help us to be comforted by his power, reassured by his humility, and confident in the fact that this is part of your plan in history. Amen. We're going to sing together.